Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Arama, today joined by Herman Pretorius. Today, we're going to be talking about a really important issue that affects almost every single aspect of governance in South Africa, and that is value for money. Every time the South African government spends money, it's supposed to be getting us, the citizens of this country, the maximum value for our money that it is spending on various goods. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen, and that's not an accident. It is unfortunately a choice. Herman, you have been—you're going to be launching a campaign targeting many of the premiers of provinces around the country to rectify this issue. Can you please tell us about what you're doing and why it's important?
Yeah, so we've all seen the headlines: a 10-cent straw procured by Transnet being procured for 27 Rand, a 10,000% markup, mops and knee pads costing thousands of rands, laptops costing millions of rands. These markups aren't aberrations in the system of public procurement. The stuff that a government entity buys or the services that it buys to be able to operate or function in its normal duties, at least theoretically. These aren't aberrations. They're not bugs. They are baked into the system to the extent that of the 1 trillion rand the government in South Africa spends on public procurement every year, up to 25% is likely going to waste, essentially, to not getting value for money.
So that, every time you hear the government saying we are going to buy this amount of things or we're going to spend this amount of money on whatever it is, let's say, I don't know, fixing the water infrastructure, just minus 25% from it.
Essentially, yes. If they say they're going to build 100 RDP houses, minus 25. They're going to buy the equipment to fix 100 kilometers of road, minus 25. They're going to procure the services to fix 100 kilometers of pipelines, minus 25. And the reason is that if you're a BEE provider and contractor, you don't have to get the contract on the best price. You can get it on other things, for example, being a highly rated BEE company. So that means you can charge more for the same thing that another firm or company or contractor can do for a cheaper price. That isn't an accident. It's not, oh, but that's just one of those unfortunate consequences. No. It's how the system is deliberately designed. Treasury has acknowledged that that premium system of BEE premiums exist. And our good friend and colleague Gabriel Krauser has really done the heavy lifting on this issue in terms of the research over the last 2 years, where he has identified 100 to 150 billion rand annually that can be saved to the taxpayer, to the National Treasury fiscus, if value for money is just the basis for procurement, which you would expect it to be. I mean, after all, Constitution, Section 217, the Zondo Commission recommendations, these things speak to value for money, to cost effectiveness, to ensuring that the people who depend on government services actually get the maximum quality, the maximum quantity of services possible. Sadly, that's not the case. And over the last few months, we have really honed in on this as an issue that we think can gain political momentum. We've done the research, published it in the Blueprint for Growth paper. The latest edition was published just in February this year, putting these numbers out there for anyone to look at and understand. But on top of that,
where can people read that? Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, on the IRR's website, there at the top, there's a drop-down menu, and then you can just click on IRR publications. And at this stage, that paper is slap bang in the middle of your screen if you click there, where it says IRRs, the IRRs blueprint for growth, cut VAT and BEE premiums. And the numbers are all there. The calculations are all there. The loss, this catastrophe that ensues when we don't do value for money, it's all in there. But to take that research and make it more than just research, the IRRs drafted this concept legislation, the value for money bill, which takes the research of the value for money paper and puts it into legal format that parliamentarians can table in parliament, that members of provincial legislatures can table in the provincial legislatures, and all the way to local government, a part of the campaign that will come. Last month, we took this issue to parliament, and we started already last year building slowly but surely the relationships and the numbers we think necessary to pass in parliament this bill into law. And it's an ambitious goal, I'm not going to lie. We need to get to 201 parliamentarians. But I'm going to be honest, we're making better progress than I thought we would. I thought we would have, you know, some of the predictable parties on side and really then just bang our heads against a stone ceiling when we get to some of the other parties. But you'd be surprised that some of our most constructive engagements have been with parties like MK. Of course, we've engaged with Freedom Front Plus, and the DA has been very promising, and we think we can get there. But from MK's side, even the EFF, I mean, there's a real value for money majority to be built. Last month, we used SONA, we used the budget to frame this issue as a national one for national actors. And now, with the State of the Provinces addresses now rolling out and the budgets coming over the next 2 weeks at provincial level, we're taking that strategy and we're applying it provincially. So this week we are making contact with 5 of the 9 MECs for finance in the country at provincial level, and we're providing them with the information, with the data, with the ability to understand this argument, and also with a draft law, with an invitation to engage with us, to show them that if they as provincial governments can either in their own domain practice value for money or help us pressure national government for value for money and the value for money bill specifically, we can ensure that our provinces aren't just vulnerable in terms of fiscal support, but that they actually can get more done, that they can ensure they can deliver better. Now, I can hear the cynics saying, "Ah, but they don't want to deliver better." Well, exposing that is part of our job. It's making sure that ordinary South Africans who understand the value for money issue better than most, I can promise you the data is crystal clear on that. South Africans understand that they have the opportunity during an election cycle to influence political parties to pivot to one thing or another. And the value for money issue has proven to be something that gains traction across the aisle. That is such a strong argument because of the amazing work done by Gabriel. And it's just something that we really are optimistic about for building across the country a value for money majority. It's not going to be quick, but we're already scoring wins. We're already getting MPs on side, getting MPs interested. And now we're taking that to a provincial level to make sure that every level of government and every level of influence can appreciate, understand, and then act on this value for money challenge to make sure we get bang for buck. Not just, you know, me and you, but everyone, especially those most dependent on government services.
Yeah, I often think this is such a fundamentally important issue, because often I think also it's not just money, it's also just quality of services provided by a lot of these companies, because you know you've already messed with the sort of meritocracy and value for money. So you see this all the time. I mean, it's in almost every story we talk about on this show. Is some project money is spent, that money is spent badly, or it's not, or the product is not delivered at the end, and you begin to sort of reach the conclusion that government basically is almost powerless to do anything, because every time it tries to do something, these anti-value for money policies and systems just suck away all the resources. And so only the bare minimum, and sometimes not even that, gets sort of pushed out the other end. And that is disastrous for everything from the police to the health system to the electricity infrastructure. So this isn't like some sort of nice issue or, oh, we can fix it with some taxes here or some less spending here or something. This is core, I think, to the problems in South Africa's economic and governance systems.
I fully agree, especially if we take into account the argument that South Africa doesn't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. Every year when it comes to the budget, we hear that, there are limitations. No, as you said at the beginning, this is a choice. The government can choose to stop doing this. The Department for Trade and Industry, the custodian of BEE burdens, can choose to stop doing this. Value for money is a choice, and that choice is currently not being made to the benefit of the South Africans, but to the benefit of a small elite cadre class at the very top.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our next story. And that this is quite dramatic, and it's another sort of major government department, I think, at a national level, falling into a state of crisis. I think the one that's happened to already is the police, who had to have the minister removed and a new one put in, and there's now the Matlanga Commission looking into it. But now the health department is facing a serious crisis. Senior health department officials were arrested on Monday, allegedly because the police said that they used a fund called the Global Fund to basically pay themselves various things. News 24 reported that the Director General of the National Department of Health, so that's the top official, Sandile Buthelezi, the Chief Financial Officer, Phineas Momogele, and Deputy Director General Percy Mahlathi have all appeared in the Pretoria Specialized Commercial Crime Court on Monday. They are accused of extracting around R1 million from the Global Fund, which is a fund meant to fight HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. It's an international organization that gets donations from everything from major charities and governments to support efforts to save lives and protect healthcare systems. Between 2025 and 2028, this fund has allocated $402 million to South Africa for various things. So it is a useful thing to have. They were allegedly appointing service providers in connection with, they also didn't just, allegedly take money from this. They set up essentially bogus disciplinary processes against whistleblowers, including a whistleblower who drafted a complaint or leaked information about corruption at the Northwest Provincial Health Department. Herman, this is, I wouldn't say it's a shock in the sense that it's entirely unexpected. I'm not particularly surprised by this, but it is a shock in that it's sort of firstly being exposed, and that's actually a good thing. We're so used to these kind of things just being ignored. But secondly, I do wonder, was this actually the real thing that caused the president to suspend the national health insurance implementation? The stated reason was because of the numerous court challenges. But if the department that was going to be setting up this huge fund that was going to suck up all of the insurance money in the country from private insurance is having its top officials arrested, not a great look. I don't know. What's your take on all this?
So I think the first point is one that shouldn't be overlooked too easily, and that is that this has come out. And it's de rigueur these days to take a shot at the mainstream media, and I take a few myself. They quite often deserve it. There's a strain of commentary, of analysis, especially in the political context, that just makes you wonder what has happened to journalistic standards. But in this instance, all kudos to Azara Karim and Alex Mitchley, who's done great reporting on this for News 24. And over the past few months, I've been looking at corruption scandals in South African history. And more often than not, reporting like this is part of the corrective measures that see these things come to light at all.
It is one of the best things about our media is that, in general, it has a pretty good nose for investigative reporting. I mean, I've talked about it at length, but the horrible Tembisa hospital saga, as far as I can tell, the only reason that we know any details of that is because mainstream media journalists from News 24 went out and really, made sure to get that story into the public eye.
So it's very easy to hate on the mainstream media, but if we just lean into that, we lose the nuance and the reality that these people, especially the investigative side of journalism, do stellar work. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I'm not sure if this is why Ramaphosa perhaps paused the NHI, but it might certainly have been a factor. I mean, it's well known that Treasury hates the NHI. Treasury understands that there's something like fiscal limitations, which Aaron Motsoaledi and Joe Pahla, his predecessors, seem absolutely unable to grasp and accept that you can't have something that at the lower cost estimations will cost 200 billion a year, and at the higher cost estimations, something like 700 billion a year, without having an idea of where the money will come from. So we don't have much of an idea about where the money will come from, but my goodness, do we have a good idea of where the money will go. And this story is one of those wonderful nuggets of insight into where NHI money will go. It'll be pooled. It'll be worth billions. It'll be worth any favor to get to. And it'll be worth any agenda to protect the patronage. And that is what happened here. We've got the NHI, and Alex van Heerfer in this piece is quoted as referring to the Digital Vibe scandal, PPE corruption during COVID-19, the Tembisa hospital extraction of, Lamborghini fame. And it is then utterly bizarre that anyone, even in the ANC, but perhaps especially Nicholas Crisp, a man of dubious integrity, can look South Africans in the eye and with a straight face say, no, of course the NHI will work. Of course it won't be looted. It won't be looted because we'll design it not to be looted. Oh, so are we saying that the current funding structures were designed to be looted? Well, at least that's a useful admission, Dr. Crisp. But it's just, again, that illustration that, proof, if proof were needed, that we are dealing with an entitled governing class, we are dealing with a gangster governing class, we are dealing with an arrogant governing class. And these people didn't become gangsters, arrogant and mobsters and, crooks and cadres and cronies, and then got into government. Government allowed them to become that. The structures in place allowed them to become that. The fact that they can have gatekeeping powers sectorally, have massive amounts of cash at their disposal, have confusion over how decisions are taken, and have the expectation of essential de facto indemnity is why we get corruption like this. So exactly. We need to start looking at closing the taps, power, not just patching the holes.
Exactly. Centralized power combined with this lack of accountability is what creates this toxic soup. And that's where, there comes a point where, one of the problems with policy in so many areas of this country is that over-centralization of power, that desire to regulate, slow things down, make everything essentially a political decision, centralize decision-making in the ministry, in national government here, spend money through national government, all of that. This is, I think, where the line between bad policy and corruption actually fades away, to the point where they kind of almost become indistinguishable from each other, which is that the bad policy enables corruption, and corrupt people pursue bad policy because it enables them to do more corruption. And so these two issues actually don't really, there comes a point where they don't even separate from each other. The socialism, the corruption in the socialism starts to become a feature for some of the politicians involved, not a bug. And I think, unfortunately, that's where we are with so many of these things. It's one of the reasons why we actually need to decentralize so many decision-making things. And that's not just an ideological point from us. I mean, obviously, we as classical liberals believe that sort of thing. But I think there's a very practical, non-ideological case to be made in at the moment for that when you look at how so many of these centralized things have gone in South Africa, where they have enabled this kind of stuff. So, I mean, we'll see what comes out. I'm sure this court case will reveal interesting details ahead. But any final thoughts on that?
No, I think you're absolutely right that if we're going to keep on putting vast powers, vast amounts of cash, limited scrutiny, and a caterized body politic together, surely at some point we have to stop thinking that we're going to get another outcome. There's upstream, there's supply side reform that can happen here, and I hope as South African politics and policy pivots from beyond just the domination era where the National Party and the ANC could do this, could just capture both policy and mechanisms and craft them to their liking. I genuinely hope that parties like the DA, like the IFP, like Freedom Front Plus, even MK can understand that structures aren't morally neutral. Policies aren't neutral. They incentivize some things and disincentivize others. And the way things are currently rigged, it's incentivizing this sort of criminality.
Yes. So we've just talked about two things. One was value for money and how that affects so much of government. And the other is corruption or potential corruption in the health department. Obviously, it's still all allegations at this stage. But, you know, sometimes that can get a bit abstract. Now, this is one of the reasons why often for this show we refer to stories from ground up. I think the people who write ground up news often have very different kind of ideological outlook on the world than we do. And yet they do a lot of very interesting sort of on the ground reporting, talking to individual people who have real problems and have been failed by the state. And these failures, I think, so the policy things we just talked about result in the story that I'm about to tell. So there's an older lady, Nonsendo Holiwe. She lives in the rural Eastern Cape in Mamupondi Seni village near Mthatha. She was diagnosed with throat cancer in 2008, but healthcare system not being what it should be, delays in accessing treatment meant that she wasn't able to get, I think, chemo for her throat cancer, and so she ended up having to have a rather aggressive surgery to cut out a piece of her throat. She now lives with a permanent opening in her throat and goes for regular checkups. She's in frail health. She lives with her three children and a grandchild in a deteriorating two-roomed mud house in this small village. The structure is damp and cold, says the reporting from ground up. The windows are broken and some are covered with zinc sheets. The roof leaks and there are holes in the wall. She told the journalists, quote, "Sometimes I go to live with relatives, especially when it's windy or rainy. I survive on a disability grant and most of the money goes towards my medical needs. It is impossible for me to build a better house for myself." Now, she did apply for a government-built RDP house through the local municipality back in 2015, so 11 years ago. Her application was in fact accompanied by a letter from her doctors. She's made numerous inquiries at the municipality over the past 11 years, saying, quote, "Every time I go to the municipal offices to ask about my house, I'm told to continue waiting." A recent housing project was launched in 2024. She went specifically to ask if she was on the beneficiary list of that housing project near her, near where she lives. She was told she's not. However, when contacted for comment, the local municipal official said, no, she's listed as a beneficiary. We found that she was not homeless, but destitute. And so we, you know, kind of fast-tracked the application. However, the company producing those houses abandoned the site in December of 2024. And it's unclear if the project will resume anytime soon. So this woman has, for the past 2 years, essentially been denied or failed by the state, whose policies were, at least in theory, supposed to protect her and ensure that she had a reasonable standard of living. And now she's looking after two generations of children in a miserable house, having to spend most of her money on keeping herself alive with medical stuff. Just an absolutely terrible story, Herman, but I think this is the real impact of what these failures result in. Why is that housing project not being built? Well, I'm sure that if you went back there, you would have found that the value for money bill probably would have either helped or stopped whatever has led to that halting of construction. If the value for money bill and the corruption in the health department were eliminated, maybe she would have gotten proper treatment for her disease back in 2008 when she was diagnosed, and she would never have ended up with this horrible surgery to cut out basically a piece of her throat. Maybe she would have a house. Maybe she would even have a job, and she wouldn't have to survive off a disability grant provided by the state. And in fact, she'd be able to, you know, look after herself in a real way. Herman, what's your take on the story?
A few weeks ago, in I think it was one of our staff meetings, we had this discussion about the socioeconomic rights contained in our constitution. And two colleagues, Terence and Anthea, gave us some historical context and anecdotes and tidbits about how at the time, the inclusion of these socioeconomic rights, right to housing, education, healthcare, etc., were seen as such a massive coup that I think the phraseology used at the time was that basic human needs have been converted into basic human rights. And the apparatchiks and the officials were so proud of that because they've been declared rights, as if suddenly the basic idea of scarcity will cease to be a problem. That as long as we enshrine into the Constitution that people have a right to housing, there shall be housing. And as long as we enshrine in the Constitution that people will have a right to education, there shall be education, spake, and thus it was so. However, what goes missing in that sort of Santa Claus type policy thinking is the fact that you're going to have to provide it, and the ability and the resources to provide it is going to come from somewhere. And that somewhere, there aren't many somewheres. You can borrow money up until a point where your interest on what you've borrowed tops R1 billion a day, as is the case in South Africa. You can tax your tax base to breaking point, as is currently the case in South Africa. You can print more money, nationalize the Reserve Bank, and get cash on hand, but devalue every single rand anyone has anywhere in an asset or saving and trigger hyperinflation. You can cut spending by sort of perhaps the value for money bill, or you can grow the economy. Now, you don't have to be an expert to understand that the growing the economy seems to be the obvious choice here. And yet, if you grow the economy at a meager pace, as is at last starting to happen in South Africa, at least, you know, from a very low base, but you still don't have value for money, then you're going to perhaps enlarge the revenue sources available. But on spending, you're going to sit with the same problem, because the more money you get in, the more money you spend, the more money gets stolen, because the patronage network is firmly in place thanks to cater deployment, BEE, preferential procurement, all the goodies. So at the end of the day, these basic human rights mean nothing to people like this woman, like Mrs. Huliwe, who has a basic human right for healthcare and housing and a clean environment, all those goodies, but her basic human needs aren't met. And there's one sentence in this that I think highlights the policy tragedy behind her situation. And that sentence is, "It is impossible for me to build a better house for myself." If any politician or policymaker were to read this story, that is the sentence that should keep them up at night. It's impossible for me to build a better house myself, because that means this lady wants a better house, has assessed her possibilities and the practicalities of doing so, and concluded that it is a problem beyond her solving. And that's where the state can actually have a positive role, where it can solve problems, where it can provide a social support system, but only if it actually understands what it is that people are struggling with. In this case, it's not difficult, as you say, to see value for money in housing and in healthcare. Help this lady be in a better position after more than a decade of waiting. But, you know, add to that the idea that how about we do try housing vouchers, where we get a policy that will remove that source of impossibility, to make it possible for this woman to say, the state, through the taxpayer, has provided me with the basic resources I have due to my destitute and impoverished state. I can either rent a place with dignity, or I can use the housing voucher to construct a place with dignity. That's point number one. And then beyond that, the RDP system in South Africa is a horrendous sham. For almost a decade after you gain an RDP house, it's not yours. You can't use it as an asset. You can't use it as security. You can't use it to generate income. It's essentially a very, very small Bantustan. It's a place where the government of the day pretends you have independence. It pretends you have dignity. It tells you to enjoy these things that it denies you, whilst ensuring utter dependence on the state's whims and wants. So we've gone from having 13 Bantustans to having however many RDPs there are, because everyone is a pseudo-independence. It is a lie. It is not a property. It isn't ownership. It is a place to breathe and die in, if you can do either. So when we look at a depressing story like this, where we diverge from the ground up people, we see the human cost. And it depresses us. It saddens us. It really affects us. But we default not to the idea that this problem, because of its humanity, must be solved in its humanity. It must be solved in policy. It must be solved at a level that won't just benefit one person from the ground up, but everyone. And that's why we do policy. So whenever you read a story like this, I urge you to find the policy failures behind it. I can promise you they'll be there. Now, I can promise you they'll be connected in some way to economic growth, not creating either the revenue for the state to step in with support or the ability of the individual to take their God-given talents and transform it into an honest income and a life. It's depressing, but there is a small chink of hope. These are soluble problems. Because of that one sentence, it is impossible for me to build a better house for myself. That sentence is such a great problem statement for housing policy that once you get serious and stuck in, the problems are imminently soluble.
Indeed. And that's why we do this, because we want to see a South Africa where stories like this don't happen, or at least are very, very rare. And with that, we shall call it to a close for today. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. Have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the fund us button.